Did Osho or Rajneesh, did he work also with terminology like structures that we have discussed initially in our conversation, or did he do other things?
I don't know, he was an amazing guy. He talked something like 500 books, you know, so he pretty much talked about everything that you could possibly talk about. And I don't really remember exactly him talking about structures, but I can't imagine he wouldn't have talked about structures.
Mm-hmm.
But for sure, in the ashram, which he very much, I mean, he wasn't there, you know, present in the ashram, if you like, but he was completely in charge of the ashram, I would say. And in the ashram, he invited many kinds of different therapists. So he was very aware, I think, of structures of the mind, and he, if you like, worked on them by inviting people who worked on them.
Yes, okay.
And in his own talks, he was more talking, he was more discussing, you could say, philosophy, I suppose, or you could, he was discussing different masters, how they worked, what their ideas were. You know, he was talking about Jesus and Buddha and Lao Tzu, and he tended to be more on that level. And the work on structures, if you like, he left more to people that he encouraged to spend time in the ashram. So I think he consciously was working with people's structures, but not personally, you could say.
And now in your work, do you, when you head this Open Sky House team, or you are the focal point of this, do you consider yourself as a master, or do you have some...
Yeah, I walk around all day with a whip, you know.
Some hierarchy.
And if they're not working enough, you know, I strike them 3 times, you know, I'm definitely the master, you know.
So,
yeah. No, it's not. It's a little bit different. No. Not much. Not much. No, I mean... I never would sit down and say, oh, you know, I'm a spiritual master. You know? Nothing like that. I mean, it's like, I'm more like a, if I would have some identification, it would be like a playful kid. And I see my role as causing things to move or something, you know, like kids... pull the, you know, you make a house of cards, you know, and the kid comes and pulls one out and it all falls down.
Yeah,
you know?
Okay.
So it's more, it's
playful
more
kid.
Like that, I would say.
Playful,
you know?
Kid. Mm.
And maybe sometimes it's very playful and sometimes it might not be so playful. So it's, there's a, a range of effect, you could say. But in another way, I could say I'm a master, you know. I mean, maybe if I would consider, you know, in a public realm or something, I would say to myself, well, I think I'm rather masterful. So then I would, in that way, consider myself a master, but not in the way most people would imagine that. It's more that I can see sometimes something happens, which I can say, wow, that was amazing. And then I can say, oh, that was masterful something.
Mm-hmm.
And also I'm, because of my own background, as far as I can see, there's tremendous advantage in working with somebody like a master. I mean, in your case, you were having some strong influence from this Jesuit master, but you also had a strong sense of doing it yourself, yeah? So you, in a way, had both things happening. But in the end, you followed his...
100%, yes.
His advice and his teachings, yeah?
It was some kind of trusting, yeah? So he said, this feels good, now go for it. It's very much like the resonance story that you talked with your, with Rajneesh, yeah? So not so excitingly related to this person, but there was a deep confidence, yes, this... makes sense.
I think it's like a love affair, you know. If I would think of my connection with Osho, for example, I did have a few meetings, but basically it was just a tremendous kind of projection of my love or something, you know.
Mm-hmm, a projection.
Kind of. And it happened also over time, you know. In the beginning there was a lot of resistance, I would say. A lot of not understanding and a lot of resistance, and it took time, and there were some devices along the way and more trust, and you know, and this got even stronger when I went to my second master, because it was a completely different situation. With Osho, he was a very splendid, you know, white marble Rolls Royces, you know, deluxe, fantastic master. And then when I went to Papaji, he was exactly the opposite. He was scruffy t-shirt, tattoos on his arms, coming in a van, you know, he was completely ordinary, you know. You couldn't really see him as a master after being with Osho, you know. There was a sort of...
Yeah, something master should be different, yeah.
I mean, I had been conditioned to imagine what is a master, and then I met this guy, he didn't, you know, didn't really fit the right, so he didn't have the right clothes or anything, you know. But of course, gradually, as I spent time with him, because he was very available, and I remember when I first arrived, you know, in the first few days, having two very personal meetings with him, much more than I'd ever had in 15 years with Osho. And in the beginning, I was like, I suppose, a bit innocent, and so I was like almost throwing myself into his house, you know, until suddenly it was like, wait a minute, this is a bit dangerous, you know.
Okay.
And so gradually something happened, and I realized that although he's very welcoming and, you know, have lunch, and of course you can stay, and actually there was a danger, you know, and I didn't realize it in the beginning, but very quickly it became clear that on the one hand, it was beautiful to have this close contact, but if I wasn't careful, he'd cut my head off, which he did, you know, quite quickly. So it was what I wanted,
yes.
And it, at the same time, it was what, in a way, I was most afraid of. So these two things were working.
But you went with the awareness that you want to get your head cut off to Papaji.
Not quite like,
yeah,
not quite like that, but yes, yes, absolutely. I mean, I'd been like that already for some years, you see. And I didn't know it then, but now I would say that it was very necessary to have this much closer contact. So in a way, as a beginner, Osho was wonderful, because he set out all kinds of techniques for meditation, therapy, and so on. He made beautiful talks that gave you lots of enthusiasm and blah, blah, blah. So as a beginner, he was very good master. But at a certain point, I think it was very important to have a different kind of master who was much more available and who could really see you on a personal level, could see your structures, be a mirror to those structures, and really work on a, you know, almost hands-on kind of way. So I think I was very lucky because, as I said before, I wasn't really... both masters just showed up in my life. And I think I was very, very lucky.
You're lucky when you have this.
I feel it was a great gift, actually. But I'm also aware that for lots and lots of people, the whole concept of having a master is completely not something they could accept or could want or even understand, maybe. So I know it's quite challenging for people.
To go into a situation that they say, I have a master now, too.
Yeah.
So to say, to position oneself in a hierarchical relationship with somebody, or what is
it? At the beginning, it feels probably hierarchical, because you probably project daddy or mummy, depending if it's a man or a woman, you project those kind of things onto that person.
Mm-hmm.
So in the beginning, it's maybe there's a feeling of, you know, he's the boss or something. Yeah? I know I felt that with Osho, you know. I mean, he was... certainly my projection onto him was like a super daddy or something, yeah, very wise super daddy. But gradually you come to realize it's not really, you realize that it's just a projection, it's not really like that, you know. And this is where going to be with somebody like Papaji, lived in a small house, came in a van, you could go and have tea with him in his house, you could talk to him very easily. Although, as I say, there was always this feeling that he could just quickly get his sword out and cut your head off, you know, at the right moment.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a sense that in the beginning, you know, the master is like beyond, you know, like you make the master as a sort of special beyond, and therefore you make yourself less.
Mm-hmm.
But over time, you come to see that actually it's the same, that mm-hmm. there's no difference. And that realization there's no difference is almost a bit scary. I remember years later, I went back to Pune and gave some meetings, some spiritual meetings, down the road, you know, just down the road from the ashram, where for many years, you know, I was very much in this role of having the master, you know, mm-hmm. and suddenly I'm sitting there having my own meetings. That was very confronting in the beginning. And then somehow it changed, and then it was, it just happened, you know, it just kind of happened.
It became natural, it was accepted, it was...
Yeah, because anyway, I'm not thinking myself as the master or something, I'm not... But it's an amazing moment, actually, when you suddenly realize that it's no difference.
It's the same,
yeah? Yeah? And in a way, you could say that that's the whole journey. The whole journey as a seeker is to come to the point where you realize you're the same as the master. There's no difference.
Yeah, and the good master will always pull you there.
And the whole effort is that you come to see that. And then, in a way, it becomes more and more friendly, you can say. Yeah. And you can only end up as friends, actually.
Yeah.
Maybe completely different personalities, different kinds of things. But in the end, there's no difference. And when you realize that, for example, I've done these interviews for my books over the last 8 years. I've interviewed about 50 masters. And I had respect for each one, but I never felt that we were different. So I could sit with them very naturally, and I was being Premananda, and they were being whoever they were, and we had a meeting. And that was very, very beautiful. I mean, I feel completely touched from being able to have that experience with many, many beautiful masters. It's an enormous gift. I mean, when I think about it, I can't imagine how it happened that I've met all these many, many masters. And to meet them, if you like... Well, with respect, but I could say equally. I mean, with respect for who they were and what they've achieved and so on. And so a lot of respect, but to see that fundamentally we were the same.
There is one master in Pune, she's called Dolano, I believe. She's a German, and I think you interviewed her as well.
Yeah, she's in the European Masters book.
And she calls herself a radical Zen master, that is what I saw in her internet or somewhere.
Yeah.
What is that, and how does she work? What does she do? What?
Yeah, I think you have to ask her, I don't know exactly.
Okay.
I mean, I like her a lot, actually. She's kind of salty German woman, you know. But she's lived in India for many years. So, how can I say with her? In a way, for me, I find her always quite funny, you know. I could enjoy her a lot. She's really, really a character. She's really a character. But then every master is a character.
Yeah.
And each master... I mean, the reason you could call somebody a master in a way is that they have no fear just to be themselves, you know? They're doing their life, whatever it is, 100%, and they have no fear about it. So in the end, they become a kind of character, you could say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, very different from all the other characters. So I always enjoy, I mean, in a way I can say I enjoyed all of them. It's like, you know, having a cellar full of good wine. It's hard to know whether you take this bottle or that bottle because they're different, but they're both going to be good. You
okay,
know?
Understood.
Something like this. But, I mean, one thing, when I talked about destiny, you didn't really want to take this destiny word. But now we've been talking about these two masters that came into my life. And, in fact, there's a third master because... already when I was with Osho, I had made contact with Ramana Maharshi through a photo of him. And when I went to visit Papaji, he had a big picture of the same man.
Mm-hmm.
So actually, existence brought me first to Osho, then to Papaji, and then to Ramana Maharshi. So I actually feel I had three masters in my life. And they all came to me without any intention. I wasn't intentionally looking for a master.
What is then the Ramana Maharshi story? I mean, when you met him, he was not in his body.
Yeah. I met him through a photo initially, and then I understood a bit about his teachings. And then through Papaji. Papaji was always telling, I'm a channel for Ramana Maharshi. So through Papaji, I met Ramana Maharshi, you could say. And then later, I came to his ashram, and now every year for the last 11 years, I've been to his ashram.
So what is a channel, being a channel?
Well, we're back in the realm of energy now, I think. You know, so I would say that everything that I've said tonight is, if you like, being channeled, in the sense that I have no idea what I've said, and I had no intention to say it. Mm-hmm. I'm aware that my mouth is moving and words are coming out, but I have no idea about it really, and there was no thought about it. It's like
it happens.
It's just happening, kind of, you know, through the organism.
So how can you say this comes from Ramana Maharshi, or in the case of Papaji? Yeah? So Papaji said, "I'm a channel for Ramana Maharshi."
Yeah, he said that. I mean, I don't know. I wouldn't say that everything I'm speaking is coming from Ramana Maharshi. I wouldn't say that. But in Papaji's case, he directly met Ramana Maharshi, and he spent a few years with Ramana Maharshi, mm-hmm. and he was completely loving Ramana Maharshi, and.
When you believe it is the self, yeah, and Ramana is the self, and you are the self, you cannot be other than the self, that would be a simple explanation. Eh?
For example, you know, there are many people that came to Ramana Maharshi, but, for example, Papaji is an Indian man, but there was an American man called Robert Adams. He also came to Ramana Maharshi and stayed about 3 years when he was quite a young man. I think he was about 20 when he came there. And if you read his book, Silence of the Heart, he talked so amazingly similar to Ramana Maharshi, from a Western point of view, you could say. But I would say he was a channel for Ramana Maharshi. But how it all works, I have no idea. For example, with this man, Robert Adams, when he was a child in his bed, he used to see a little figure walking on his side of his bed. And when he was a teenager, he discovered opening up a book that was Ramana Maharshi, for example. So when Robert would talk about being a channel for Ramana Maharshi, it's a different level of channeling that I would, recognize or something. You know? So somehow, I don't know how it works, but obviously this man had a tremendous connection to Ramana Maharshi, however it works, I don't know. He went to see him, you know, and prostrated the first moment they met. Robert actually took his clothes off and prostrated on the ground in front of Ramana Maharshi, who was walking down the mountain. And Ramana Maharshi said something like, "Oh, I've been waiting for you," you know, so... I don't know what all that's about, you know.
Okay.
And in my case, I had something a bit similar with Papaji. You know, our first meeting was a bit like that. Just, poof, we met, sort of like it was meant to be.
So then let's discuss this destiny subject a little bit. you made me curious now. Yeah?
Well, I think it's very interesting, you see, because if I look back now from where I am here, and look back 30 years... I'm be looking back 40 years. When I was 20, I had these kind of inner questions, some kind of inner question. And it seems that this inner question has kind of powered my life, you could say. Because this inner question, first of all, took me hitchhiking around Europe, you know, then it took me to Japan, and then in Japan it took me to meet this man who introduced me to his master, and then it took me to his master, and then, you know, years later took me to this other master, and then from that master I got introduced to Ramana Maharshi. So all that just happened, I could say.
Yep.
So I would call that my destiny unfolding, because there was nothing conscious about it. And in fact, consciously I was probably resisting most of it. mm-hmm. but it still happened.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems to me that there is some force inside us or outside us, there's some force where our life is unfolding.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we can see that and accept it, we can a bit relax, you know, because it's like, anyway, it's going to happen. So you might as well just say, okay, you know. And then this idea that I'm doing my life, which is a lot of work and a lot of effort, you know. If I'm doing my life, you know, it's a big job then. But you can sort of see how things unfold. And if you don't care really what the destination is going to be,
then it's easy.
You can just accept it, you know. It's going to be, I didn't know, for example, I would meet you. You suddenly turned up on the screen, and then you suddenly you're coming here, and now we're sitting here, you know. So I mean, you know, I mean, I'm it's very nice way to live. I find it's a beautiful way to live.
No intention. Yeah. Also here, it just happened. Yeah.
It's
also an experience. But destiny again would propose that there is something that controls it. Yeah. I don't know.
I don't know if control is the right word, but there is a kind of unfolding, I would say.
Unfolding.
There's like an unfolding. Yeah. And how that unfolding is determined, I don't know.
Yeah, there are some sequences also in my story, and together with my family, that where I had the impression there were events that were like razor blades, one on the other. Yeah?
Mm.
That in the end of the day, a certain result could happen. Yeah?
Mm.
Such situations happened, yeah, or seem to have happened, and this gives us the idea of maybe something like destiny. Yeah. But I don't even trust that one, yeah, so I don't.
Yeah. And I think it brings up a sort of fundamental possibility that there's not really any point, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That life is not having a point or having a goal, or you know, there's, it's a bit confronting in a way, you know, because if I really believe I'm somebody, this somebody wants to do something, you know, and get some sort of credit for this something.
Yeah.
But if there isn't really anybody and something is unfolding, then you can't really take it very seriously, because anyway, you know, it's like without any point.
Yeah, but this, exactly this not taking it so seriously, this pulls you, at least this is the experience here, it has the tendency to pull into the present moment, into what is, what actually is. And
right.
There's not much more than that which can be perceived. And thoughts are perceived, feelings are perceived,
yeah.
The body is perceived, so, and then it's finished.
Mm-hmm. Now we've done reincarnation and destiny, we could try death, you know. That
death.
Would be another good topic. And
body.
It's like, as I'm getting older, for example, you know, I can't really have any idea about death anymore, you see. I'm sure when I was younger, there must have been a lot of fear about it. But now, as far as I can tell, there's no fear about it. And sometimes, I mean, it's like it becomes nothing really.
It's not relevant.
It's not really, you know. It may be relevant to the person that's going to pick up the body and have to dispose of the body. You know, then I it's not so convenient for that person. You know, but for the one who's dying, or you know, it seems to me that nothing really happens.
Yes, that was an amazing point when I saw that. It's not relevant. It's also in line with this perspective of energy unfolding and condensating in different forms. Then no form can be relevant. So how can the body be relevant?
I remember some years ago, when I was living close to Papaji, I did quite a lot of abstract paintings.
Mm-hmm.
And one day I did a painting which I called Death.
Mm-hmm.
And I was quite surprised, because the actual painting kind of just spontaneously appeared, and then it was clear to me somehow that, oh, that's death, you see. And then I looked at this, nobody else would see it as death, of course, because it was just little marks on the paper. But what actually, what death appeared to be was everything fragmenting. So it was, nothing was really connected to all the other things. You know, it was like little bits of something, all kind of with space around.
Mm-hmm.
So sort of fragmenting.
Mm-hmm.
So somehow when I looked at this painting, I thought, yes, that seems to be exactly what death is. It's like everything fragments.
Yes.
And if you could say life is the opposite, it's all
yes.
coming together and everything is kind of...
Like the wave that's created, it rolls
yeah.
a certain
yeah.
period and then it
yeah. falls
decays.
Back in the ocean. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I therefore could imagine the possibility of reincarnation, that this is going, you know, goes on and on in time.
It seems to be, here it is sensed as the most natural process that is. And that's life.
It's also interesting that from a scientific point of view, there's quite a lot of reports now about what they call near-death experiences, where somebody has died, apparently, their body seems to have stopped, but then this person has had some kind of happening, but then they've come back into the body, and then the body starts to be animated again, and they call this somehow near-death experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems that it's completely joyful,
mm-hmm.
even incredibly blissful, to the point where, in a way, people are given a choice, you know, and it's like, well, I don't really want to come back, but because I've got a young son, I should come back, or something like this, you know. It's like, it seems that there's something very attractive.
Mm-hmm. I've spoken to such a person. There was a TV movie a couple of weeks ago. He must be quite famous, this guy. He's in Weimar, the conductor of the symphonic orchestra, and his near-death experience happened during a New Year's Eve concert. They were just performing the ninth of Beethoven, and somehow he collapsed there. And then they put him together, and he saw how they tried to reanimate him, and his feeling was, no, don't do that.